Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. They're called evolutionaries. These are scientists, theologians, philosophers, psychologists, and technologists who apply the idea of evolution to their own disciplines and beyond. And my guest today says they'll help us better understand our complex contemporary world. Carter Phipps is an Oklahoma native, author, journalist, and one of the leading voices in the emerging fields of evolutionary philosophy and spirituality. For the past 10 years, he's been the executive editor of Enlighten Next magazine and been at the forefront of contemporary discourse on science and spirits, and his writing have played a key role in making important new thinking accessible to a wider audience. Phipps' areas of interest and expertise range from metaphysics to politics to science and technology. He's co-founder of the Institute for Cultural Evolution and a board member at the Open Future Institute. He's also the author of a new book, Evolutionaries, Unlocking the Spiritual and Cultural Potential of Science's Greatest Idea. It's published by Harper Perennial. He'll be signing the book tonight at a special book signing at Barnes & Noble at 41st and Yale. The signing gets underway tonight at 6 o'clock. Carter Phipps is my guest today. Carter Phipps, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Rich. Very nice to be here.
This book, Evolutionaries, looks at evolution in a far larger way than we're used to thinking of evolution. You say evolution as an idea transcends biology. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think sometimes we think of evolution, the way evolution's gotten kind of framed in our culture, understandably, is through evolutionary biology and through Darwin. And, of course, that's a big part of how evolution came to be the idea that it is. But the point I try to make in the book is that this idea of development and change over time, that we're part of this evolutionary process that is not just biological but really transcends biology, is something that was, in a way, evolution is an idea that was there before Darwin. It was an idea that was popular in culture before Darwin. And as an idea, it's always included more things than just biological, you know, evolution, just Darwinian natural selection. And what I explain in the book is we're realizing that we're part of a, for example, cosmological process. We've been part of this evolving universe for the last 13.7 billion years. We're starting to recognize that the universe is not just a place, it's a process. It's actually, you know, we're part of this 13.7 billion year temporal process.
Because at this point, we can see almost back to the creation.
That's right. It's this,
and we can see where, you know, that creation process has led, the furthest galaxies and formation of galaxies far from the center.
Exactly. And we start to realize, oh, we're not just adrift in this kind of, you know, this vast, meaningless universe. It's a little more subtle and profound than that, what we're discovering, which is that we are the, you know, we are part of this 13.7 billion year process that's been developing. The universe had a beginning. It seems to be developing in some way, and it may have an ending for all we know. And so what does it mean to recognize ourselves at the advancing edge of that 13.7 billion year process?
That drift you were talking about, the fact that there was no aim, that's a little bit controversial in evolutionary circles. And that's also one of the big divides between those who believe in the philosophy of evolution and the theory of evolution, those who don't.
Right.
That purpose and aim is something that's missing a lot of times when we talk about evolution.
Exactly. And that's
where it's controversial.
And that's where I think that it's unfortunate that evolution has been often associated for reasons that we can look at historically, but I don't think makes sense anymore. Evolution as an idea, especially as a biological idea, has often been associated with a sort of a purposeless, meaningless view of the universe and of
mutation,
human life.
Mutation for the benefit random of the species.
Random mutation, natural selection, straight kind of neo-Darwinian view. And what I'm saying is that I'm not trying to argue against that by any means. That's good science. There's a lot to back up that. That's fine and that's great. But we can expand our understanding. Even many scientists who are looking just at the science are expanding our understanding of what evolution means and looking at just, even if we just look at the science for a moment, looking at the science and saying, wow, this is an incredibly meaningful process that we're part of, and they're exploring that in all kinds of different ways. And then once you go beyond maybe just the strict science, you look at the way different philosophers are beginning to look at the evolution of human culture and the way, you know, social scientists and psychologists are beginning to explore the evolution of human culture. You know, we talked about 13.7 billion years. What about the last 10,000 years? What about the last 35,000 years since we became Homo sapiens sapiens? Then there's a whole, you know, set of new theorists who are beginning to look at the evolution of human culture and human consciousness over the last 35,000 years. And that begins to, we're part of an unfolding cultural process. What does that mean? Science is just barely trying to grapple with that. But there's a lot of new theorists who have amazing, interesting new ideas about that.
You look at how far humankind has, and I would say this gets into another question, evolution versus progress.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
what are the terms, you know? Because when you look at the last 500 years, how people lived 500 years ago to now, how people lived at the beginning of the 20th century now to the beginning of the 21st century. Incredible changes. Incredible changes in what defines a suitable life, you know, as far as your political autonomy, your economic economy, autonomy. And so how do you define that evolution versus progress? Because I think a lot of times people would think of that as progress, not evolution.
Well, and I think they're connected. The two are related and connected. And of course, it's delicate. Whenever we talk about progress, it's a delicate point because, as we can see, as we witness the evolution of culture over time, there's different ways you can track it. You can track it on the external world, the evolution of our political and social and economic institutions, and people talk about different ways to track evolution through that. And I talk about those certainly in the book. And then people talk about the evolution of our internal world, the evolution of our cognition, the evolution of the complexity of our thinking, our capacity to take perspectives, our capacity of awareness in some sense, the evolution of that also evolves over time. I think our capacity, your cognition, the capacity that you have and that I have to sit here and have this kind of conversation and, you know, imagine ourselves as part of this kind of vast universe in the way that we're doing, and imagine ourselves as part of this process, that requires certain cognitive capacities that I don't think were present in the same way 35,000 years ago, 40, 50,000 years ago, 10,000 years ago, maybe not even 3,000 years ago. So what's that evolution about? And we're just starting to get our hands around that. So in so many ways, we're just starting to capture what it means that we're part of this developing process.
Now, I want to talk about one of the very first things you talk about. And it's about getting people to wrap their head around evolution in this bigger, larger term. You grew up in Oklahoma. I grew up in Oklahoma. You know, we know that there's been this huge divide between science and religion. And I'm interested in how you're interested in breaking down these barriers.
Yes.
I just had Lynn Goodman, who's a Jewish Orthodox thinker, who said, you know, both religion and science can't really live up to their potential until they see the value of the other.
Beautiful. That's very nice.
And it's interesting that it's such a zero-sum game between both camps a lot of times.
Well, I think this is one of the most unfortunate truths about the situation in our culture with the idea of evolution, which is that it's been kind of hijacked by the science and religion worldview clash. And it's not really a clash, ultimately, I think, between science and religion. It's a clash between certain types of worldviews, one that happens to be more religious, one that happens to be more scientific. But evolution has been hijacked by that. And part of the message I'm trying to convey in the book is that we don't need to revert to pre-scientific views of the world, you know, in order to find very rich forms of meaning and purpose. I myself have very, you know, I consider myself to be a deeply spiritually oriented person. And I see tremendous spiritual richness in the view of an evolving human culture, of an evolving human plan, of evolving kind of planetary a system and an evolving cosmological process. There's tremendous meaning in that. That's a spiritually rich view of the universe. And I interviewed, you know, Catholic theologians, you know, Protestant theologians who have this very rich new vision of what it means to understand the nature of God in an evolving world. And there's nothing, to me, that should enrich our understanding of religion. And I think this is one of the messages that's unfortunately not gotten out into the culture as broadly as it should, because the culture's kind of locked in this view. If you believe in evolution, then somehow you're against religion. And if you are a religious person, then somehow that means I have to kind of reject the idea of evolution just because I'm a religious person. And I think that's just so unfortunate. And I hear people sometimes say, oh, evolution, that's a, you know, I don't believe in evolution, that's a bad thing. And I know what they're really saying is, I don't believe in that thing that is antithetical to my deep religious convictions. But I don't think evolution needs to be antithetical to anyone's religious convictions.
My guest today is...
Or at least most people's.
Yeah. My guest today is Carter Phipps, former executive editor of Enlighten Next magazine. His book is titled Evolutionaries, Unlocking the Spiritual and Cultural Potential of Science's Greatest Idea. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. You know, from a strict Christian perspective, I think Jewish scholars would look at it differently. They would say this is a different writing, but the Bible itself has this progress or evolution of what God is like from the Old Testament to the New Testament.
That's true. That's true.
I think Jews would say, well, it's a matter of who's writing the story, who's taking down the story.
Well, you could look. Yeah, there's different ways to look at it. And I would say that even, you know, one of the things I mentioned in the book is that even our deepest understanding and even our experiences of a divine reality, whether we're talking about Eastern philosophy or Eastern mysticism in some of its forms, or Western, you know, Judeo-Christian theology and you know, even our deepest experiences of divinity and of God, in some sense, you can see they evolve also through time, and you can track that. And the Bible's a good example of that in some sense. You can see our understanding of what divinity means, our understanding of what reality means, what God means, and that is evolving in the development of the Bible itself in some sense. And that's an interesting truth. So in an evolutionary universe, more things are evolving than I think we realize sometimes.
Of course, if you take that monotheism further to Islam, all of a sudden the Creator God changes yet again.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if that is evolutionary or that's just three different perspectives.
Well, it is three different perspectives, and I think sometimes we imagine that human culture is evolving in lockstep. So, you know, 1 billion or now it's 7 billion human beings are evolving in exactly the same, trajectory at exactly the same moment throughout history. And I don't think that's correct at all. I mean, I think, you know, sometimes certain cultures, you know, progress forward in various ways, and then they run up against certain problems and pathologies, and then maybe they fall back, and then other cultures kind of push forward, and you have this... You know, just like, if you look at the last 100 million years of biological evolution, it's a little bit that like that. You know, certain species kind of push forward and others kind of then fall back. And I think you see that with human cultural development as well. So, and you have to remember with cultural development, you know, there's this interesting dynamic, and people forget about this often, is you have certain kinds of progress. And progress always goes with certain new pathology. So we had this in modernism and the Western Enlightenment, we had this extraordinary breakthrough with this new perspective on the world, this new way of understanding the world that led to the Industrial Revolution and all the economic gains that we earned from that and lifted so many people out of poverty and just so many advantages. You can list them one after the other. And yet, then there's the pathology. You have the environmental damage. You have the dislocation of our social networks. You have all these pathologies that go along with that progress. So evolution is always this interesting mixture of progress, but then pathologies. And as those pathologies arise, then new perspectives and new worldviews will arrive to address those pathologies. So it's never too simple. It's never too linear. We have to think about this in a complex way.
And that's one of the ways you think of what you call evolutionaries. Mm-hmm. There are three characteristics.
Right.
So what do you mean by evolutionaries? Who are they?
Well, in essence, I'm evolutionaries to me are people who begin to integrate into the way they think about human life in the 21st century this temporal perspective, you know, this sense of being this product of this developmental process, part of this developmental process. What does it mean to see human beings at this time in the 21st century as part of this unfolding cultural evolutionary process, this vast process of biological evolution, this 13.7 billion year cosmological process? When we start to see ourselves as part and parcel of that process, this is a new one. We just begin to understand this in culture the last 200 years. And really the last three or four decades, really it started to come into more into the cultural, just starting to hints of the cultural mainstream. And so what does it mean as we start to integrate that to our understanding? Well, I think it changes our sense of what it means to be human in the 21st century. And so evolutionary is really a term I use for those people who are beginning to integrate that understanding of that sense of temporality, of development, of being part of that process into their understanding of what it means to be human. And of course, it changes in extraordinary ways how we understand this journey.
And what are the characteristics? You say the first in this increasingly complex 21st century world where everyone is a specialist in everything, that they have to be generalists, cross-disciplinary generalists.
Yeah, well, I kind of make this point, and I say that one of the characteristics I found by interviewing all these different people, I interview scientists, philosophers, visionaries, theologians, mystics, all kinds of people. And one of the characteristics I found is that they were all...
I'm sure they were all specialists in their own field, but they were able to...
Many of them, if not most or all, essentially all of them were exactly as you're saying, specialists in their own field. But they were able to generalize across multiple fields of knowledge and pull information from multiple fields of knowledge. And I think in our time that's so important. One of the problems with this explosion of knowledge we've seen in the last century, last two centuries, last decades, is that, as I say, we're data rich and meaning poor. You know, we have so much content and we don't have enough context to understand it. And we need more. We need people who can help make sense of it, who can draw patterns and connections across multiple systems of knowledge.
I want to take this in a different direction, but our culture is really drawn towards specialists and people mm-hmm. knowing a lot about one field. Is the next current having a new culture of generalists who can sort of synthesize what the specialists are saying, who can make meaning of it?
I think that's a critical step that we need to take in our culture. And I definitely start to see that. And one thing about evolution is an integrative idea. As the Jesuit priest said, Teilhard de Chardin, he said, evolution is a light that illuminates all facts, a curve that all lines must follow. And he meant that evolution is more than just genetics and biology and a little bit of paleontology. It's an idea that because we're part of this process that really transcends just a biological process, it's a cultural process, it's a cosmological process, you need an understanding of multiple fields of knowledge to appreciate it. And it helps to integrate all these different fields. And already you see, in different ways, you see there's a whole new school of philosophy called integral philosophy that I talk about in the book. And that's a whole approach that is trying to integrate multiple systems of knowledge. So I think the rise of the generalist is something we will see in the next decade.
And just as that Jesuit priest was talking about it, seeing the big picture, if you will, mm-hmm. the long timeline, mm-hmm. that is mm-hmm. another part of what you would say is a part of an evolution.
Exactly. So you need that capacity to integrate multiple, to kind of reach out with tremendous breadth and integrate multiple systems of knowledge. That's one of the qualities I was talking about. But also then, it's not just breadth, but depth, you know, to appreciate that developmental time. What does it mean when you and I begin to appreciate that we're not just, you know, that we're not just made up of our, you know, 40 or 50 or 60 years of psychological history, but of, you know, of 35,000 years of cultural history is also within us, and then 3.5 billion years of biological history, and start to understand our own selves as expressions of that, and then, you know, all the way back. And so when we start to, I was aware that as I interview people, if you start to look about, people are beginning to have even deep insights into what it means to be part of that developmental timeline. Even what we would call almost like spiritual experiences, where they have these almost, you know, flashes of insight, where suddenly they see themselves and it all unfolds in, you know, this moment of intuition, this whole process, and they're part of this and they're connected to all this entire developmental process, and they have these awakenings, evolutionary epiphanies, I call them in the book, or one of the theorists calls them. And that's a new type. It's like a new type of awakening. You awaken to this developmental nature of life and of oneself. And
that gets into a little controversy itself, because in pure evolution, there's no real direction, is mm-hmm. there? I mean, it's about natural selection that helps in the competition, that helps that species continue to propagate itself, to adapt to yes. environmental changes. And it's about competition mainly, but there's no real direction. It's not necessarily progress.
Well, I think most evolutionary theorists are even beginning to admit that there's direction in something. There is a directionality to it, even though when you get into things like purpose and meaning, then you're getting out of just strict science. But even the directionality, I mean, it's pretty hard to argue too strongly against directionality. You know, you can say it's all blind or accidental, but the reality is, I mean, the you know, as I say in the book, you know, if you look at the history of human culture, there seems to be some kind of direction of at least of complexity, you know, unfolding there. I mean, if you look at where we're gone to, if you play the tape of the Earth, you know, kind of over the last 3 billion years, you probably would know which direction was forward and which was backward. And I think that implies that there's direction. So I think most scientific theorists will even admit some directionality. But then you're right. There is certain controversy about some of these things. And I'm sure that some scientists might read this and say, wow, that's great. I never really thought of that. And some would read it and say, you know, this is wrong. You're taking evolution in ways you shouldn't take. And I accept that. I understand. I'm happy to speak to debate those points.
The third sort of characteristic of evolutionaries are they are optimists. They do believe in that time arc that involves progress.
Yes. I think that One of the characteristics I felt in almost all the individuals I interviewed, whether they're more coming from the science or more coming from a spiritual religious context or more just more of a cultural philosophical context, is that they were all these, there was this kind of deep sense of potential and optimism that they shared. And I think that's really important because, you know, we need to, as human beings who are facing the kinds of challenges we're facing as a human culture, we need to believe in the potential of the future. There's something important about it. We need to believe that we can contribute. And that's, and of course, we have to remember there are many dimensions of what's going on right now. One of the dimensions is that you and I are having a conversation about this evolutionary process we're part of. That means we're becoming consciously aware of this process. Now, that's never happened in history. We've been blind to that we're even part of this larger process. You know, and it's like you're driving a car and your eyes start to flutter open and you start to realize, oh my God, I'm going down the road. I have steering wheel in my hand, but I've been asleep, you know, and you're just starting to wake up to that process. And what's the potential is that you start to put your hands on that wheel and start to try to drive this more consciously and be more aware consciously of where we're going. And as we're facing so many challenges as a human species right now, it feels like there's nothing more important than having a sense of faith, and not in the inevitability. There's nothing inevitable. There's no guarantees here. I don't think there's any inevitability that we're going to go forward, that we're going to progress further. I mean, there's nothing. At the same time, you can see the tremendous challenges we've overcome as a species. Just in the last 10,000 years, you can see how we've gone through these different, you know, developmental challenges and how we've come through them. And when you begin to understand that, and you begin to understand that one has the capacity in some small way through one's own capacity of choice and freedom to contribute to this process, it gives one a deep sense of faith in the potential of the future. Not the inevitability, but the potential.
My guest today is Carter Phipps. His new book is titled Evolutionaries: Unlocking the Spiritual and Cultural Potential of Science's Greatest Idea. He's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. We have just a few minutes left, but a short example of how this idea of looking at evolution beyond straight biology. You talk about Lynn Margulis' work on the origins of the nucleated cell, bacteria began to cooperate rather than and be competitive. Symbiogenesis, I believe, is the term.
Symbiogenesis.
Yeah. You look at how something like that affects Australian fishing rights and fishing regulations. You make this connection. Share that story with us.
Well, there's an Australian theorist who I speak about in the book named John Stewart, who wrote a book about the direction of evolution and, you know, pointing to the directionality. And one of the things people are starting to see is that evolution is not just about, it's not just a dog eat dog, you know, red in tooth and claw, all about competition. That's the, you know, all about selfish genes and selfish interest world. And that's been the kind of the way evolution's been painted, which is another one of the reasons often religious people have run the other way, right? And when we start to say, well, it's actually much, there's more going on in nature than that. Certainly that's true. This isn't a touch, you know, this isn't a Hallmark card universe. You know, it's a violent universe, and it's a competitive universe, no doubt. But cooperation and sociality has been built into the nature of evolution since the foundations, even before biological evolution. Even if you look at like the formation of the carbon atom, what makes the carbon atom such an important atom such important element, you know, is because it you know, as I say in the book, it hooks up with other elements easy. It forms bonds easy. It's very social, the carbon atom. That's probably why it became such a great foundation for life. So you see, cooperation is built, and Lynn Margulis' work showed us how bacteria came together to overcome environmental challenges and form the eukaryotic cell in the early prebiotic soup. And that was a critical, that kind of cooperation among bacteria was absolutely critical for forming that, the eukaryotic cell, which is the foundation of all higher forms of life on the planet. So how does that affect us at this point? And one of the insights that John Stewart had was that, you know, if you track all those breakthroughs in evolution, you see that evolution is about, you know, the right kind of cooperation, and how do you get different distinct individuals to cooperate in important ways. And he was dealing with Australian fishing rights, which was that some fishermen would overfish, and then that messes it up for everyone. So how do you get people to all agree and do the right things? Is if everyone starts overfishing, then everyone loses. So how do you get people to respect that, you know, if we all toe the line, then all of us will benefit. And so the way he talked about it, he talked about us, the right kind of governance is necessary to help those who cooperate outcompete those who are selfish. You know, and he did a lot of research on this, and it was very interesting, some of his insights. So part of what we're trying to do, and as we think about our global governance over at a cultural level, because this is a big issue, we have all kinds of international issues we're dealing with, right? Part of what you're trying to do is you're trying to structure a kind of global governance in ways that allows more higher and better forms of cooperative arrangements to win out over kind of selfish nations that are just doing their own thing. And so there's some patterns here in the evolutionary process that can help us as we form global structures that help us kind of deal with some of these issues.
I thought that was a great example. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, though, mm-hmm. evolution has given us some really bad mistakes from the past. And yeah. we've taken, social Darwinism mm-hmm. in the late 19th century, eugenics in the early 20th century.
Sure, yeah.
How do you make sure that what you're taking out of this evolutionary proposition and moving it out of biology is always going to be a good idea?
Well, there's no guarantees. You can't. That's up to us. We have to do that. And we can see the disasters that have unfolded at times. And this is another, certain religious critics like to point to this, that Darwin's responsible for Hitler. Well, no, it's not like that. But there is a relationship between, some distortions of certain evolutionary currents in culture used in a highly simplistic way, and that that were related to certain kind of fascistic ideas, about one culture's better than another, and this my culture's progressed more than your culture, and of course those are real dangers, and in the hands of people who have a very nefarious motives, and all these things can be abused. Evolution is a powerful idea, and then powerful ideas can be abused. But that doesn't mean, but it's also an idea that's revealing great truths about the nature of culture, and we need to pay attention to those truths.
For the average modern American living their life who, bombarded by media, information, where do they see evolution at play that they're really not aware of? In just our last couple of minutes, can you give us a sense of how far-reaching this idea goes?
Well, you can say in the simplest way, you can say that, I have an iPhone in my pocket, right? You can see the evolution of, and I have a whole chapter on the evolution of technology. The iPhone changes every 2 years. We didn't have iPhones 20 years ago. I think we're all aware that culture itself is there's this kind of speeding up quality that's happening. And I think everyone's kind of aware of that and doesn't quite know what it means. And is aware that where is this going and where are we going to be in 20 years? And we see that the evolution is definitely this increasing speed of change is happening in the external world and certainly in the technological world. And it's disconcerting and it's exciting and we don't quite know what it means. And a lot of theorists say that's not just an aberration. That's part of the evolutionary process itself. What you're seeing with technological change is connected all the way back and is intrinsic to the nature of cultural evolution itself. So part of what I'm doing in the book is saying, well, we need to appreciate that that's happening, and we need a worldview that helps us understand the nature of change and the nature of evolution, both in the external world, like when we're talking about technology and institutions, but then also to help us understand how our own internal world needs to evolve and can evolve to catch up with that on the external world.
All right. Carter Phipps, it's a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Rich.
Carter Phipps, the former executive editor of Enlighten Next magazine and the author of Evolutionaries, Unlocking the Spiritual and Cultural Potential of Science's Greatest Idea. It's published by Harper Perennial. He'll be signing the book tonight at 6 at Barnes & Noble at 41st Street and Yale. Also, a book signing tonight from BookSmart Tulsa, James Osland. You might remember him from Savour Magazine's The New Comfort Food. We spoke with him back at the first of the year. Food writer, editor-in-chief of Savour, and Top Chef Judge will have a signing tonight at 7 o'clock at the Community Food Bank of Eastern Oklahoma. He'll be my guest tomorrow on Studio Tulsa. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.